From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. We're a winner, and never let anybody say, well, you can't make it, cause a feeble mind is in your way. No more tears do we cry, and we have finally dried our eyes, and we're moving on up, moving on up. Curtis Mayfield, the great soul singer and songwriter, died yesterday at the age of 57. We'll remember him with a 1993 interview. Also today, we begin Writers Week, featuring some of our favorite interviews with writers from our archives. Today we'll hear from Norman Mailer, a writer who was famous by the age of 25 with the publication of his novel The Naked and the Dead. We'll also hear from Fran Lebowitz, a writer famous for her wit and her longtime writer's block. We'll talk about writing and not writing. Writers Week begins today on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Space Shuttle Discovery is making its landing right now at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. High winds at the landing strip forced the space agency to delay the landing about 2 hours ago. The shuttle's returning after a successful mission to repair and upgrade the Hubble Space Telescope. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak's largest coalition partner is threatening to pull out of the government. The crisis centers on a budget dispute, but it could affect peacemaking with Syria and the Palestinians. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports from Jerusalem.
The ultra-Orthodox Shas party is threatening to resign by tomorrow unless the state spends more money on religious education. Shas maintains an extensive semi-private school and welfare program, the key to its grassroots support. But its programs are some $24 million in the hole. So far, budget makers have refused to bail them out. A vote on the budget is set for this week, and many analysts see today's move as simple posturing. If so, it may well pay off. Without Shas, Barak would lose his majority in parliament, and Shas leaders support trading land for peace. Barak needs their influence as he heads into a crucial phase of peacemaking. He's due in the U.S. next week for more talks with the Syrians. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Immigration officials say they're holding seven Jordanians detained on the Canadian border on immigration violations, not suspicion of terrorism. The border crossing at Blaine, Washington was shut down for about 2 hours yesterday while officials checked the status of three men, two women, and two children. They say several of the people had outstayed their U.S. visas, while a woman, a man, and a toddler who were legally in Canada crossed the U.S. border illegally. Officials say there's no evidence to link the group with terrorism. A second tempest is sweeping through France from west to east, south of the path taken yesterday by what's being called the storm of the century in France. NPR's Sarah Chase reports from Paris.
The Pyrenees Mountains and the coastal areas around Bordeaux are taking the brunt of the latest storm that's crashing into France off the Atlantic. But it's drenching the northern part of the country in rain and snow, complicating an already daunting cleanup effort from yesterday's winds. Firemen are trying to chainsaw their way through hundreds of tangled trees blocking one Paris area highway. The head of Paris Park says cemeteries will get priority for cleanup, then the gardens where millennium festivities are planned, like the grounds of the Eiffel Tower. But she's planning for a three-year cleanup job. Meanwhile, 1.5 million homes are without electricity. No wonder more than 120 massive high-voltage pylons went down. And the country's already plunged into more bad news from tonight's storm. Sarah Chase, NPR News, Paris.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 14 points to close at 11,391. This is NPR. The man credited with making ABC into a top-rated television network has died at his home in Florida. Leonard Goldenson was 94. Goldenson bought ABC when it was near bankruptcy in 1953. At that point, ABC was the number four program distributor after CBS, NBC, and the now-defunct DuMont Network. By 1977, Goldenson had brought ABC to the peak of viewer popularity with shows such as Happy Days and Charlie's Angels. Competition for customers is forcing long-distance companies to offer cheaper rates and new savings plans. Sprint is offering free service as part of its new package. Bloomberg's Paul Lynn reports from New York.
Sprint will offer a free hour of calling on Sunday nights for 6 months. It's an attempt by Sprint to get more new customers signed up for the Nickel Nights long-distance plan, offering 5-cent-a-minute calling from 7 at night to 7 in the morning, but 10-cent-a-minute calls at other times. The drive for new customers comes at a time when Sprint now is in the local telephone business in the state of New York. And Bell Atlantic, the local phone provider, has been approved to sell long-distance service here. AT&T and MCI WorldCom also sell local phone service in New York. For NPR News, I'm Paul Lynn in New York.
Protesters from Greenpeace smeared oil on the headquarters of Total Fina Oil Company in Paris today, dumping the carcasses of oiled seabirds and blaming the Franco-Belgian oil company for the oil spill that's blackening beaches on the northwestern coast of France. The oil comes from a tanker chartered by Total, which broke up off the coast 2 weeks ago, spilling about 3 million gallons of oil into the sea. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This is Writers Week on Fresh Air, featuring some of our favorite interviews with writers from our archives. Norman Mailer once wrote that before he was 17, he had formed the desire to be a major writer. Well, that wish certainly came true. He was famous at the age of 25 after the publication of his war novel, The Naked and the Dead. He won a Pulitzer and National Book Award for Armies of the Night, his reflection on the 1967 anti-war march on the Pentagon. He won a second Pulitzer for The Executioner's Song about Gary Gilmore. As novelist Scott Spencer wrote, for a writer to inspire the controversy and divisions that routinely orbit Mailer's life and career is perhaps unprecedented in American literary history. Some of the controversies to which Spencer referred have been about Mailer's macho code, his feuds with feminists, his venture into politics running for New York City mayor, and his championing of writer and convicted killer Jack Henry Abbott. Now there's a new biography of Mailer, written by Mary Dearborn. I spoke with Mailer in 1991, after the publication of Harlot's Ghost, and he told me he's still very productive because he has to be.
You know, I got myself into a situation which I'm not at all unhappy about, but it is there. I have 9 children, and I'm all too famous now for having been married 6 times, and so there's a bit of alimony to pay, and the children are all going through college or have gone through. But I have to earn a lot of money just to keep going, which is fine because I think I'm essentially lazy, and if I didn't have to do it, I wouldn't be writing as much. And ultimately, I'm happy I've written all these books, although I do groan and gripe all the while I'm working on them.
I think you were one of the first great American writers to also be a media personality, and to have that personality be, in a way, a part of your art. Do you think of yourself, or at least your public self, as being one of your greatest characters?
No, I'm amused by it because people have such an outlandish idea of me, and I'm always intrigued with it. They really are so surprised when they meet me. You know, if I've heard one remark 1,000 times in my life, it's that, oh, you know, you're not the least bit the way I thought you'd be. I'm a measure of how bad and inaccurate the newspapers are. Most, after all, the sad truth is that most people who write for newspapers are mediocre writers. So the mark of mediocrity is to look for precedent. So they'll open the files on me, and whatever's been written about me before gets written again, thereby confirming the error.
But you did at some point, I think, almost make a decision to cultivate a public personality on TV, you know, on the Cavett Show, on Merv, on David Susskind's show, you know, saying really provocative things. I mean, you even write in advertisements. I think it was in advertisements for myself about how you'd kind of like study TV to think about how you could best come across on it and to most kind of accurately get across the thought or the emotion that you wanted to.
Yeah, but I've given up on that. I don't think you can communicate through TV. Some people may be able to, but I can't. My ideas are too...
complicated?
Yes, too complicated, too full of... I'll say it, too full of nuance. When you start trying to communicate through TV or, for that matter, through newspaper stories, your remarks get garbled and bizarre. I mean, whenever I read a story about myself, I generally shudder a bit. I say, oh, what a bizarre, ugly... sort of off-balance person I appear to be in that story.
You used to always measure yourself against other writers in advertisements for myself, you wrote. It is my present and future work which will have the deepest influence of any work being done by an American novelist in these years. I could be wrong, and if I am, then I am the fool who will pay the bill. Do you think your assessment of your own work has changed over the years?
I think I'm a little more relaxed about it. Either my work will or it won't have all that huge effect. Sometimes I hope it will. Sometimes I think it absolutely won't. My real fear these days is not who's going to be the best writer of us all, but whether novel writing as such is going to continue with any health into the 20th century. I'm not sure it's going to. I think 50 years from now, novelists may be looked upon as the way most people regard poets, which is, oh, they do a very special kind of work. It doesn't have much relevance to my own life. I read a poem once in a while, people say. So I think in 50 years I can say, you know, I think I'm going to read another novel this year. It'll be a most special and peculiar activity almost, because I think television is driving everything else out.
But how do you size yourself up now when you compare yourself to the other major writers of your generation?
Oh, I think, I'm not going to name them. I think about three or four of us who may last, and I would say I'm one of them.
To many younger writers, you've become a father figure, and I wonder what that's brought out in you, different from the competitive instinct that you always had toward writers of your own generation.
Well, I'm not competitive anymore because I'm beginning to recognize that what's important is that we keep writing novels, that the 20 or 30 or 40 writers in America who have real talent keep working and keep doing more and more, because I think we're the only people who can define the country. And I think we have a duty. So I think it's good when any one of us breaks through and does a good book or a rich book. We help the others. I wish the level of our writing was as high, let's say, as the writing in Latin and South America. I mean, they have great writers there, any number of them, four, five, six you could name. And I'm not sure that we do anymore.
Your image has always been of the two-fisted intellectual. And you've said that you were a physical coward as a child. When did being manly and being able to fight become important to you?
In my second marriage, my then-wife's father had been a professional fighter. And whenever he came over to visit us, he used to say, come on, let's put on the gloves. He was about 20 years older than me, but of course he knew more about boxing than I did. So I learned quickly and the hard way. And then after that, I got interested in it and did more and more boxing. And then I became friends with a couple of professional fighters. And finally, I've had a great friendship with Jose Torres over the years and have boxed with him a great deal. At one time, he was the light heavyweight champion of the world. Now, of course, boxing with someone who's as good as that is relatively safe because, he can handle you with no pain, and therefore he has no particular interest in hurting you. But I did learn an awful lot about defense while boxing with him, because if he tapped me once, and then if I didn't make the proper move the next time, he tapped me a little harder. So after a while, he put a great many instinctive defensive moves into me.
But getting back to that image of the two-fisted intellectual, why was that important to you, to not just be a bookish intellectual?
Well, I could answer you by saying, why not? What's so wonderful about being a bookish intellectual? If you're just bookish, there's a tendency to get terribly bitter about people who are physical. And my feeling always from the beginning was, if I want to be a novelist, I've got to be a novelist who can encompass all kinds of experience. My ambition was always, don't ever narrow down the horizons of what you want to write about. Try for as much as you possibly can try for. Learn more all the time. It's stultifying to be a novelist unless you keep opening up working with larger and larger, not necessarily larger and larger canvases, but either larger canvases or more powerful themes.
You went from Harvard into the Army. I think you fought in the Philippines during World War II.
Yes.
Was that the first time that physical strength counted more than intellectual ability in your life?
I would say so, yes. In fact, I went through... I grew up in Brooklyn, and we didn't ignore strength in Brooklyn, but I grew up in a reasonable neighborhood, reasonable middle class neighborhood. But I do think that the what counted for more than strength or the lack of it was the fact that I went from Brooklyn to Harvard to the Army. So I went through two major transitions in 5 years, and the shock of that. And then a few years later, The Naked and the Dead was written and came out. So in a space of about 8 years, I went through three major transitions. The third being that I went from being an unknown young man to who just recently gotten out of the army to being a young celebrity, and that was the largest transition of them all. It was extraordinary.
How did who you saw yourself as being compare when you were in Harvard and when you were in the army?
Well, I just had a totally different view of myself. You know, young people at Harvard. Harvard was a wonderful place in those days, and you were coddled a bit. You know, we were treated as gentlemen. We were treated as young people who are going to be, without ever saying it, the assumption was that we were going to play a reasonably interesting role in life, and everybody cultivated everyone else's opinion. I remember it as an incredibly polite place and very nice, and even if you were discriminated against, you never knew it. It was all done so subtly. Whereas the Army, of course, was rough as a corn cob, and so that was a huge transition. And then I wasn't very good in the Army. I wasn't a good soldier, and I'd gone from having a rather elevated opinion of myself to a poor opinion of myself. So my ego was on the elevator in those days.
In what way weren't you a good soldier?
Oh, I mean, I just resented close-order drill completely. I don't think I ever learned to march properly or present arms or any of that stuff. And I don't know. I just wasn't a particularly good soldier. If you had 12 soldiers in a platoon, I'd be the third or the fourth from the bottom.
Was it important to you as a writer to be in the Army and meet men who weren't like you, who weren't from the same background or the same region?
Oh, I think it turned me into an altogether different kind of writer. If I'd never gone to the Army, I believe I would have written novels that probably would have been a little bit like the works of Iris Murdoch. Maybe not as good, but I would have had intricate philosophical novels with characters who, to say the least, would be somewhat extreme and distorted and intense. And going into the Army, talking in quick terms, maybe much more of a naturalist.
Was your ego intact after the military when you started to write?
No, I went through my ego was battered. And I went through the war very much with the attitude of, when I get out, I'm going to write a book about it, expose this damn Army. Now, everybody I knew in the Army was saying the same thing. But I used to think, yeah, they're saying it, but I'm going to do it. And I hated the Army. Now, looking back on it, I'd say that the Army was the 2 years that I spent in the Army were the worst experience of my life and the most valuable.
You know, you said your ego was on the elevator, you know, between Harvard and the Army. It really started to be on the elevator when you started to write. You know, The Naked and the Dead, as you say, made you into celebrity, but your next two books weren't reviewed as favorably, didn't sell as well. What kind of mood swings did that create in you?
Well, huge mood swings, but the happy end to the story is that by now I have an ego that I'm afraid is like a battleship. Just try and sink it.
Is it good or bad for a writer to have a big ego?
It has its advantages. Obviously, you can go through a mess of bad reviews. And, you know, most of my books over the years have had more bad reviews than good reviews. I'm the only major writer in America who has had more bad reviews than good reviews in the course of his writing life. So that gives me a certain a pride in it. You know, I feel, well, you know, they keep taking their shot, their best shot, and they can't do a goddamn thing, and they're not going to stop me. And, you know, and you can get a little vain about it that way. But the bad part about having a tough ego is you become less percipient. Ego is a shell, essentially. And so you start to close off experience from yourself. The ideal would be to have a light, flexible ego that's there, that can concentrate in a given place to protect you when the going gets tough, but that it doesn't cut off too much. At my worst, I often feel like a turtle. I just pull my head in and let it rattle off the shell.
Right.
But, of course, I'm not seeing a damn thing except my own darkness at that point.
We'll hear more of our 1991 interview with Norman Mailer after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our 1991 interview with Norman Mailer.
You know, you might be one of the few major writers of your generation who is Jewish and for whom Jewishness hasn't been a major theme in your fiction. Do you think that's true, that you're one of the few?
Yes, and I think it hasn't been a major theme, but I think on the other hand, it's informed every sentence I've written. You know, being Jewish is a state of mind. It's a way of receiving life and perceiving it and evaluating it, and it affects every one of one's judgments. It affects one's style. In fact, it was Norman Podhoretz, once remarked many years ago that there were two kinds of Jews in history, he felt, if one were to speak very generally. One was the essentially Orthodox Jew who returned to tradition and was deeply enmeshed in it and thought of himself or herself as a Jew and primarily a Jew and always a Jew. And then there was the Jew who became the mirror of the time and aped the manners of all those people who were not Jewish, didn't copy them literally, but became so sensitive to the manners of those who are not Jewish that he might end up knowing more about it than they did. One example of this is, although he was not Jewish, his parents were Jewish. Disraeli is a wonderful example of that. He didn't look British, but he was more British. He was more English than the English. So in that sense, I think I would belong to that second category. I've always been interested in writing about things that are not Jewish precisely because I half understand them and I want to know more about them. But I think that, I've never said to myself, well, I'm really not Jewish. I know damn well how Jewish I am.
I think that kind of is consonant with the image of the writer as spy. You know, the writer is always looking at the people who he's not a part of.
Well, that's very good, by the way. You know, the writer is spy. I think in a way, writing about the CIA couldn't have been more natural for me because I've been a spy all my life. So I can understand spies.
The writer Blanche McCreary Boyd had an appreciation of your work recently in The Village Voice. She wrote, Mailer's work has demonstrated an aggressive sexism, and he has, as a consequence, become a cultural icon of offensiveness about women. Do you think you deserve to be a cultural icon of offensiveness about women?
Well, why don't you read the rest of her?
Oh, she loved your work. I just thought this was one way of getting to this issue. I should say here, she really loves your work and the new novel as well. Just to put this into context.
Well, I just shrug when we get into that because she started with that to show the distance that the book took her.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, as she read the book, as I understood her review, she was saying, in effect, I'm beginning to forgive him more and more because this book is so good. And finally, at the end, she was saying, it hardly matters what I think his ideas and his attitudes are toward women. I love this book because it just keeps me reading and so forth and so forth. Whatever. It's hard for me to talk about a good review. After all, a man my age who's preening is kind of silly. But as far as being an icon of the awful to a lot of women's liberationists, yes, it's absolutely true, but I also think it's silly. I don't think they read me. I think they proceed on a notion of me that's very little to do with what I really write about all the time. I think if they were to read what I write, they'd be startled. On the other hand, I think the worst of the women's liberationists are incapable of reading. They're interested only in political correctness. So how the hell can they read?
I wonder if you think that the best aspects of the women's movement, the most open and least doctrinaire, have affected your view of women or your view of yourself as a man.
Oh, no question. It's been going on now for 20 years, and it's had a huge effect. Some for the good and some for the bad. I think what women are maybe beginning to face now is as they gain equality with men, they're also going to be taking on all of men's problems. And a great many of men's problems are just dreary. And on top of that, since men have been, in effect, wrecking the world, let's speak ecologically, look what man has done to the natural world, the question is, once women become equal to men, are they going to then begin to direct the world into better places? There's very little evidence of that so far. One's idea of women's liberation at this point is women in trim, gray business suits carrying small attaché cases working as high executives. Isn't that the general perception of what women's liberation is about these days? That at the very least, even the most hidebound corporation has to have its token woman in a high office?
It's one narrow part of it. I want to read something that you wrote in the 1950s in Advertisements for Myself. You wrote, Fitzgerald was an indifferent caretaker of his talent, and I have been a cheap gambler with mine. As I add up the accounts, I cannot like myself too much, for I was cowardly when I should have been good and too brave on many a bad chance. And I spent my first 30 years abusing my body, and the last 6 in forced marches on my brain. And so I am more stupid today than I ought to be. My memory is half gone, and my mind is slow. From fear and vanity, I paid out too much for what I managed to learn. I may have wasted too much of myself, and if I have, What a loss. Can you update that for us? Do you ever feel like... Do you ever feel those kinds of emotions that you expressed when you were 36 in that passage?
No. In the act of writing that, I was able to move away from that. You know, much of writing is I wouldn't call it exorcism, but it is transformation. Very occasionally, it's transcendence. If you can absolutely capture a state of mind at a given moment, then you very often are freed of that state of mind. That was written out of the deep fear. In those years, it was written out of the deep fear that I had ruined myself.
From
these abuses, you know, pot, booze, all of that. But I think in the course of writing it, some little part of me said, well, stop complaining so much, because actually this is rather a well-written passage.
At the age of 68, which you are now, do you feel that you have no time for certain shenanigans that you participated in when you were younger?
Oh, time is obsessive now. Not obsessive, that's too strong a word, but it's present in almost every thought I have, put it that way. You know, I don't know how much longer I have, 10 years, 15 years at most, and there's so many things I want to get done yet. So, no, I have no time for shenanigans. I've got to get the work out.
So how has that changed your public life, the public Norman Mailer?
Well, I'm much quieter now. You know, a lot of people complain secretly. They say, you know, Norman has gotten so mellow, he's boring. But I'm not at all the public figure that people think I am. You know, I mean, I haven't been in a fight in it must be 15 years. I stopped boxing 8 years ago. I'm a man of 68.
Has your approach to writing and rewriting changed at all over the years?
I'm talking about
the process.
Yeah. Well, I now look upon myself as having somewhat less talent than I had when I in the middle years, but I have much more skill and savvy, and I'm a much better editor of my own work. I'm sure that any number of reviewers would disagree, but in any event, that's the way I feel. And so I feel if I can get something written that's halfway decent, by the time I get done editing it, it'll be pretty good. Whereas in the old days, I used to write with more smoke and less savvy.
Norman Mailer, recorded in 1991. A new biography of him by Mary Dearborn has just been published. Our Writers' Week series continues in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Sisiv, building custom e-business systems for global 2,000 companies worldwide. On the web at CYSIVE.com. And from Bantam Books, publisher of Snow Crash by Neal Stephenson. Snow Crash, presenting in America at the time we are now entering, with Stephenson's cyber sensibility. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, we remember Curtis Mayfield with a 1993 interview. The great soul singer and songwriter died yesterday at the age of 57. Also, we continue our Writers' Week series with Fran Lebowitz, a writer famous for her wit, social commentary, and her writer's block. We'll talk about writing and not writing.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This is Writer's Week on Fresh Air. After two best-selling books, Metropolitan Life in 1978 and Social Studies in 1981, Fran Lebowitz was hailed as one of the wittiest writers of her generation. But soon after that second bestseller, she became famous for her writer's block, which lasted over a decade. She says she's not blocked anymore, just very slow. For the past few years, she's been working on a novel called Exterior Signs of Wealth. In 1995, after she'd started writing again, we invited her to talk about writing and not writing. We started with a reading from an essay featuring variations on the theme of not writing, the topic that she says preoccupies most writers.
Variation on this theme number one. You can't write. You call another writer. He can't write either. This is terrific. You can now talk about not writing for 2 hours and then go out to dinner with each other until 4 o'clock in the morning. Variation on this theme number two. You can't write. You call another writer. He is writing. This is a great tragedy. He will talk to you only as long as it takes for him to impress upon you the fact that not only is he writing, but he thinks that what he is writing is quite possibly the best thing he's ever written. Your only alternative to suicide in this situation is to call a rock musician. This makes you feel smart again, and you can get on with the business of not writing. Variation on this theme number three. You are writing. Another writer calls you to talk about not writing. You announce that you are. Masochistically, he inquires as to what it is that you are writing. You inform him modestly that it's just a little something vaguely reminiscent of, say, an ideal husband, perhaps a bit funnier. Your behavior at his funeral the following day is marked by enormous dignity and grace.
Fran, when did you write that?
I think I was in my 20s. I'm in my 40s now.
Are the feelings expressed in that reading still feelings that you have?
Actually, not, in the sense that I don't think about other writers at all anymore, which I guess I did then. If my life was more collegial at that time, by which I mean I hung out in bars all the time, and so that I think I had more contact with other people in that way, you know, perhaps more competitive in the sense of were they getting work done. Now I just assume everyone is getting more work done than I am, and I go from there.
It's interesting because you have, you know, you became famous for your writing, and then you became famous for not writing. In a way, it's really quite a racket. I mean, you're very famous for not doing something. Can you make a living not writing?
I did. Barely. I mean, you don't do very well. Let's put it that way. No, I didn't make a living not writing, but I managed to make a living even though I wasn't writing.
Doing what?
Talking. Mostly what I did during the several thousand years that I wasn't working was I did a seriously inordinate number of college lecture dates, by which I mean almost nonstop. And so I just talked. I read from my old books, which were getting older and older. and then I would answer questions from the audience in an entertaining fashion. And I did that. I went from college to college. I was the Willie Loman of literature. It was a very depressing period of my life.
So we're talking about this in the past tense. It's ended?
Yes, it's been ended for about 2.5 years.
And you're writing what?
I'm writing a novel.
Called?
Exterior Signs of Wealth.
Now, that's the novel you said you were writing in the early 80s.
Yes, that's the novel that I was supposed to be writing when I finished social studies. The idea was that I would now write this novel called Exterior Signs of Wealth. But then I stopped writing. So when I started writing again about 2.5 years ago, it was the same title and in certain respects the same novel, although, of course, not at all the novel I would have written then.
What changed that made you able to write again?
And I really don't know. I mean, just as I don't really know exactly why I couldn't write, but perhaps in some way my fear of writing became eclipsed by my fear of not writing. You know, 10 years, that's serious. You know, you begin to say, well, this is serious. Also, I think that what happened was it became harder work not to write than to write. And so I went with the easier thing.
Well, what do you like and what do you hate about writing?
Well, I used to say that I liked nothing about writing, that what I liked about writing was having written. But now, in my middle years, I actually find writing to be, if not really pleasurable, at least more interesting than the rest of life. This probably is a function of my age. I mean, life is more interesting than writing when you're young, and life is newer. Now, I think it's more entertaining, at least to me, to reflect upon it than actually to have to live it.
I'm interested in your writing habits. You know how some writers have, like, a couple hours every day
where they sit down and write, and they're very disciplined about it.
Yes, I've read about them.
Have you ever tried that? Has that ever worked for you?
That's the thing I really envy. For instance, they sent me all at once every Paris Review ever printed. And what did I do? I sat in my apartment for a month, read every single one. But what I was really interested in reading the Writers at Work series, mm-hmm. were things like how many hours a day did other writers write? Mm-hmm. And how much writing did they get done?
Yeah, and how much is enough for a day?
And I'm always, you know, I actually don't have that many friends who are writers. And when I meet writers, that's the only thing I want to ask them. I mean, the fact is that if I met Proust, I would say, so, how many words do you get a day? You know, and do you write in the morning or at night? And do you think if you write in the daytime, you have more chance of getting more work? That would be my only interest. When I was living in Princeton, I was really getting work done. I worked in kind of two periods, you know, during the course of the day. I never, ever sat at a desk before 3 o'clock in the afternoon in my life. I mean, not since there was algebra homework on that desk. You know, not since I was a child. And then I would write from, like, 3 to, like, 7, and then starting again maybe about 10 to 4 or 5 in the morning. Hmm. I always have had a habit of writing at night. When I was in Princeton, I tried also to write in the afternoons, since I realized that there was no point in just sitting around all day waiting for night to come, which is what I'd done most of my life. And it gave me gives you a second chance, so you don't feel so depressed if you don't get anything done the first time around. You know, but I've always found it easier to write at night, I suppose, because I'm more alert, first of all. And it just seems quieter.
No, I think in every writer, there's the writer and the editor. And sometimes the editor can choke the writer because you pick up, you know, you start writing, you go, oh, not good enough. Start over again. Oop, not good enough.
I don't think there's a difference. The uh-huh. writer and the editor. I mean, writing is editing.
But I mean, is there... is there a part of you that you have to turn off in order to write, in order to, like, get out the sentence, and then you kind of summon back the editor to groom the sentence afterwards?
I've never been able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, inside of me is a Nazi general. You know? I mean, there, and that's why, you know, I write a sentence a day. No, the editor is not only present in me, but omniscient. We don't go on to the next syllable, to that previous syllable is perfect. So that I'm sure that I would write more if I was less critical of myself. But I am, you know, I'm just as critical of myself as I am of others. So that's pretty harsh.
Is that one of the things that makes it so hard to write?
It's one of the things that makes it so hard for me to write.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think you should make it hard for yourself to write so that you're easier to read. If you're easy on yourself when you write, you're going to be hard to read.
So it wouldn't work for you to just sit down and you know, let it flow, just write, not worry about how it reads, and then come back again another day and be really critical and edit it and rewrite it and so on.
Well, you know, I think that I don't write in drafts.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that partially that's just a habit. You know, it's like saying I write with a pen as opposed to a pencil or... but part of it is that when, you know, one of your chief concerns, if not your chief concern, is style, it's really impossible to do that. Writing in drafts is for people who have either information to extend to the reader, which I don't, or emotion. You know, I don't know, that must be the reason people do it. I'm simply unable to do that. You know, it's not that I think this is a better way to write, or, you know, or a worse way to write. It just, I would be unable to do that. I mean, my concern for, first of all, when you're writing things that have the intent to be humorous, you have very few tools at your disposal. And the primary tool that you have, other than what is what you're saying funny, is the rhythm of it. So that mostly what I'm doing when I'm writing is counting syllables. So that the rhythm of the sentence is right. So if I replace a word, I have to replace it with a word of the same number of syllables. This, I realize, sounds probably totally insane to the people who are listening. But a lot of the time when I'm writing, that's what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
So that, and I constantly read aloud to myself, you know, so while I'm writing. So it's just not really possible for me to write in drafts like that, although I'm sure I would get more work done.
We'll hear more of our 1995 interview with Fran Lebowitz after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1995 interview with writer and social satirist Fran Lebowitz.
Let me say something that I've never quite understood about you. On the one hand, when I hear you talk, I always think of you as somebody who could probably live a solitary life just fine and doesn't really care what anybody thinks. And on the other hand, when I read about you, it's often in the context of some kind of scene, you know, being at a party or your views on the nightlife or something. I've never been able to reconcile the part of you that's gone to so many parties with the part of you that seems to me to exist as this kind of like solitary person not caring what others think.
So, I am both.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I'm alternately, unusually, and even gratuitously gregarious. On the other hand, I'm really very solitary. I've lived alone my entire life. My entire adult life. I've lived alone since I was 17. I would never consider living with another human being. It'd be out of the question. And when I'm not at a party or out in that way, I'm by myself reading. But I like both things. I mean, both things are important to me. At this point in my life, I would prefer to spend more time by myself. And especially when I'm really working on my novel, which I haven't been since I've been selling books as opposed to writing them. I rented a house in Princeton, and I stayed there for 14 months, and I very rarely came to New York. And I very rarely saw anyone at all. And I found it a very pleasurable experience.
Hmm. When you say you wouldn't ever live with anybody, not even a lover?
Especially not.
So do you find that it makes for a good relationship to not live together?
No.
That doesn't work either.
No. having good relationships in the way that you mean it has not been a priority in my life.
Oh, okay.
You know, I am the only person in my generation who doesn't think that you get to have every single thing in the world all at once.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or even ever. No, I'm sure that to have a very good relationship or a very good marriage, you have to devote quite a bit of attention to it. It's out of the question that I would be willing to do that.
Right.
I don't think that probably is a good idea.
If you don't mind my asking, you're in your, what, early 40s now? Mid 40s?
I'm 44.
44. Does being 44 bother you at all? Do you know what I mean? Like, if you get a gray hair, do you care? If you see wrinkles on your face, does that bother you?
First of all, I've had gray hairs since I was about 17.
Mm-hmm.
So that we're not at all surprised. But, you know, it turns out that my gray hair was just a phase. I don't have it anymore.
You outgrew your gray hair.
I outgrew it. So, you know, it just came and went.
Yeah.
Yes, of course, I can't stand getting older. I mean, I don't know anyone who likes it. Mainly because I think, or it seems to me, that I at least at some point in my life felt that age was immutable. In other words, I think that I thought, well, there's all kind of people in the world, you know, young people, old people, tall people, short people, black people, white people. And I guess I thought that I was like young people, old people, that I was like a short, young, white one. And that this was going to be the case forever.
That was your condition.
Right. And I don't know what did I think about other people that, oh boy, they're not very smart shoppers. Look at the body that they got. I got this 20-year-old body. They got that 40-year-old body. So that I think I was astonished to discover that it wasn't going to stay that way. And, you know, I can't say that I've welcomed it. I can't say that from a physical point of view, no one likes getting older. I actually noticed, since I've been on this book tour for about 80 weeks, that I actually, a lot of people notice they start to look like their mothers, for instance. I just skipped that phase. I look just like my grandmother now. I went from looking just like myself to looking like Lily Splaver in one fell swoop. And then I had dinner with my cousin in Chicago, and I said, I look like grandma now, don't I? And she said, yes, you do. That's where I am now from a physical point of view.
So what do you do with that feeling? I mean, do you feel like, well, I'm going to look like my grandmother with attitude, with defiance, I don't care? Or do you think, well, I'm going to be really depressed about this, or I will cosmetically change myself through makeup or plastic surgery? You know what I'm saying? Like, what do you do with that feeling?
Well, here's what I do about it. I look in the mirror and I think, you look better now than you're ever going to look again. And you're going to... If you have a picture taken of yourself today, in 5 years, you're going to look back and say, you look so young. You look fabulous. However, except for the look part of it, I like being older otherwise. I mean, there are advantages to it. First of all, everyone who's in charge of everything is someone you know. This is very helpful. This I like. And so I find that quite an upside. It doesn't balance it out. You know, I would rather, of course, be 20. But you don't get that choice, so you might as well take advantage of some of the upside of things. And there's certainly less urgency in life, which I also welcome. Now, a lot of people don't like being this age because it's certainly less exciting, but I'm happy to have it be less exciting.
So are you going to obsess about how you look, or are you going to not care about it?
Well, it isn't that I don't care about it. I'm pretty vain. It's just that, what can you do about it? I mean, you mean, am I going to have a facelift and stuff like that? I don't think so, because I think it's better to look like an earthling, don't you? I have no moral opposition to facelifts, but they only work for a couple years, uh-huh. And then you get this kind of Neptunian quality to your face. So I don't think that they don't have all the kinks out yet as far as I'm concerned. I just don't think there's not that much at our disposal to do that much about it. So I kind of accept it. Also, I'm a heavy smoker. You know, there's a chance. How much further is this going to go? You know, I mean, that a lot of people worry about being really old. You know, I mean, actually an old person, like a 90-year-old person. And I don't worry about this too much.
Fran Lebowitz, recorded in 1995. She's still at work on her novel Exterior Signs of Wealth. Coming up, we remember Curtis Mayfield. This is Fresh Air. The great soul singer and songwriter Curtis Mayfield died yesterday. He was 57. His health had been deteriorating since 1990, when he was the victim of a freak stage accident. He was performing at an outdoor concert before an audience of about 10,000 in Brooklyn, New York, when a lighting scaffold was blown over by a gust of wind and fell on Mayfield, breaking his neck, leaving him paralyzed from the neck down. Last year, his right leg was amputated because of diabetes related to his injury. We're going to remember him with an interview recorded in 1993. Curtis Mayfield's legacy includes his hits with the Impressions, such as Keep on Pushin', It's All Right, We're a Winner, People Get Ready, and Gypsy Woman. He also wrote the score for the 1972 film Superfly. Here's the title track, which made it into the top 10. Your grandmother had a church, the Traveling Soul Spiritualist Church. Did you hear her preach a lot?
Oh, yes. Reverend A.B. Mayfield, Annabelle Mayfield. And, of course, I heard her preach a lot. And I probably, even in my sleep, subconsciously observed a whole lot of her sermons. And I believe through herself and my mother, who was quite fond of all types of music and poems and things of that sort. She used to read to me a lot of the old Paul Laurence Dunbar writings and lyrics, and I was quite acquainted with the limericks and Dr. Seuss of the old years. And So, and of course, I identified with her teaching me a few things on the piano as a youngster. So through these two ladies, I believe over the years, I've carried out not only my ambitions, but theirs as well.
Now, did you sing in her church?
Yes, I did as I became older. Around 7, 8 years old, I became acquainted with my cousins who was a part of the church, and they started a group known as the Northern Jubilees. And I believe this is what sort of laid out my fundamentals as to harmonies, because I can recall years ago of our playing and my watching this black and white specialty record, which was 78 RPMs then, and listening to such artists as Sam Cooke and the Soul Stirrers, the Five Blind Boys, and of course you'd have to wind up this Victrola that we had and insert needles every so many records to keep, you know, to keep it going proper. And this is how I got started, I believe, with my harmonies.
What part did you sing in the group?
I was always a tenor.
When you started playing guitar and started writing songs, were they secular songs or gospel songs?
They were what I would think pop songs, you know. While I have written a few gospel songs, which would be looked upon as gospel, I call them more inspirational. Such songs as People Get Ready and Keep On Pushing. Keep On Pushing actually was written as a gospel song. However, I found that all I need do was change one lyric or one word, and it was pop for us.
What, the word was God that you would change?
That's right. Instead of God gave me my strength, I said I've got my strength, and it don't make sense not to keep on pushing.
Keep on pushing. Keep on pushing. I've got to keep on pushing. I can't stop now. Move up a little higher. Some way or somehow. 'Cause I've got my strength. And it don't make sense not to keep on pushing.
You became the lead singer of The Impressions after Jerry Butler left, and the first hit that you had with you as lead singer was Gypsy Woman. This was, I think, 1961. So you wrote the song, you sang lead. It's a great record. It's funny. The lyric is about something that I'm sure you had absolutely no firsthand knowledge of. You know, a gypsy woman who, you know, all through the caravan, she was dancing with all the men. I mean, did you know any gypsy women when you wrote this?
No. And that's absolutely true. But I saw lots of Western movies.
Oh, right. I'm sure I saw the same ones.
Yes. And it's funny, 20, 25 years later, I'm in Germany, and I'm performing in concert, and I'm hearing people, you know, calling for Gypsy Woman, which was in the repertoire, but I hadn't come to it yet. And after the show, I had an interview such as what we're doing now, and the interviewer spoke in terms of there being lots of gypsies in the place, which was out of the ordinary. Gypsies never came to concerts. And, of course, they asked me about it, and I had no idea other than maybe the song. They liked the song. Well, after the interview, across the street, I'd been invited to a restaurant where there was about 50 to 75 gypsies, all the men sitting in a circle and their women in the middle. And when I walked in the place, they gave me a standing ovation, great applause. And one of the gentlemen came up to shake my hand, and they say, "Curtis, we've been waiting for you for 20 years.
Why don't we play the impressions people get ready? And maybe before we hear it, you could tell us about how you wrote the song, when you wrote it, what was going through your mind then.
Well, I can't really recall when I wrote this particular song, but this is a perfect example of what I believe has laid in my subconscious as to the preachings of my grandmother and most ministers when they reflect from the Bible. You know, people get ready, there's a train coming, there's no hiding place, you don't need no baggage, you just get on board.
Curtis Mayfield, recorded in 1993. He died yesterday at the age of 57. Fresh Air's executive producer Danny Miller has also been in the director's chair today. Our Writers Week series is produced by Kathy Wolf. Our engineer today was Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Train a coming. You don't need no baggage, you just get on board. All you need is faith to hear the dealers honing. Don't need no ticket, you just thank the Lord. So people get ready for the train to Jordan, picking up passengers coast to coast. Faith is the key, open the doors and board 'em. There's hope for all among those loved the most.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Little Brown & Company, publishers of Fortune's Rocks, a novel by Anita Shreve, available in hardcover nationwide. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue Writers Week, featuring some of our favorite interviews with writers from our archives. We'll hear from Tobias Wolff, Richard Price, and Jane Rule. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.